Moi ben, pois moitas gracias. Cando queirades, comenzamos o diálogo. Como xa indicamos no comezo, podedes dirixirvos a Lisa ou a Lea Yu, ela traducirá a resposta, sei que non hai problema ningún, e como sempre sabedes que isto é un clima de diálogo e de informal, co cal non hai que repensar moitas cuestións, senón que falar sen barreiras e tranquilamente que o que se trata un rato despois da excelente intervención de Lisa. Cando que irades.
Maybe you can each tell me what you study so we can have a sense of who's doing what just for a minute or where you're coming from. So that I have a sense. You know who I am, but I don't know who you are.
Un poco con cada uno que vaya diciendo lo que trabaja, el ámbito de trabajo para saber, ¿no? Que la quiere saber un poco. Que...
¿Ya?
En la Universidad de Santiago de Compostela, en la memoria histórica.
Will you translate for me?
Yes, Civil War in Spain.
Excellent.
Memoir,
the same thing, yes, okay.
Team of research on, yes.
Okay, excellent.
Historical memory,
yes.
Civil War.
Uh-huh. An architect, excellent. It's a beautiful city to be an architect in. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I did my undergrad in here in history, in Polytech history.
Uh huh.
Now I was very interested in the
Uh huh.
We are a practical politician and feminist.
Uh huh, great. Uh-huh. On Mexican political parties, particularly the PRD.
PRD, yeah. It's such a
yes.
Huge one.
So don't be shy. You can ask anything, even about something you didn't understand or hear about or anything. Any questions? Yeah.
I would like to thank you first both for your presence and your presentation in this very interesting and as well controversial topic. And I would like to congratulate you, particularly Lisa, for your book Ambiguities of Domination. And I enjoyed it and I found it really appealing and stimulating. Not only because it's a cultural analysis that puts the emphasis on meaning, cultural aspects, domination, but also because it makes a strong effort to keep the Weberian accounts of political legitimacy and authority updated and applied to the Syrian case. So that's very challenging in that sense. But I would like to drive the attention to a particular point you develop in this book. Is this very clear division you find between the majority of Syrians, which show a very distanced view, or they show themselves to be very skeptical, very even showing very reverent attitudes in relation to this culture and propaganda, which reinforces Al-Assad leadership on the one hand, and on the other hand, the political elites and the cultural elites, which show a much clearer respect to the qualities and the greatness of Al-Assad. But from my experience, although I don't know, I mean, I don't work in Syrian politics, but from my experience, I had the chance to meet at least five graduate students in some of the world-class universities. And I found really shocking the social mobility in the Syrian case, specifically with regards to the other Middle Eastern regimes. I mean, all these guys I met, they share three basic features. First, they come from really low class and very poor backgrounds. Second, they are fully funded either by the government, direct or indirectly, and they are studying some of the best universities in the world. And third, they share a very strong defense of the Syrian status quo in general and Al-Assad leadership in particular. So In fact, I mean, this can be evidenced really easily with one sentence. One of them told me, he's my friend, he told me, the best day of my life was when I shake Asma's hand when she gave me the scholarship for coming here. So it was like...
هو حب الكتاب تبعي غموض السيطرة وفكر إنه إنه عم بحكي عن الثقافة والعلاقة بين الثقافة والسياسة هذا شيء كتير مهم بس هو بيعرف السوريين اللي موجودين بأوروبا هلا خمسة منهم وكلهم كانوا من الطبقة السفلى تحت وكلياتهم بيحبوا الأسد وهو كان بده اياني ارد على السؤال من هاي ناحيه واحد منهم قال انه افضل يوم بحياتهم لما هو كان بيمسك ايد اسماء فهمت علي اوكي سو اي ثينك يو جوتن اون ا بوينت ذات اي واز تراينج تو جيت تو ان ذس برزنتيشن ويتش تو سم اكستنت واز جرابلينج وذ سم اوف ذا ويكنسز of ambiguities. So Ambiguities was a book that was very narrow in the sense that it was dealing with explicitly, flagrantly fictitious claims. I wasn't dealing with the rhetoric in general. I wasn't dealing with support in general. I wasn't dealing with anything outside of the cult of personality. So I was looking very specifically at rituals of obeisance that were transparently phony. That's the narrowness of the book. Also, one arguably could say, you know, its elegance on some level. But it does make its findings limited. It was a question that no one had asked. And as you point out, it also undercut a kind of certain Weberian set of assumptions that had been guiding social science research. So the first thing I would say is that it was very narrow. And the second aspect of the book that I think you're registering very astutely here is that it was dealing with a very specific time period, a time period in which the kinds of prosperity that you're talking about had yet to occur in quite the same way. There was a commitment around the welfare state to provide a certain amount of goods and services. Some of that actually has gone away. But in this current more neoliberal era, for lack of a better term at the moment, these market openings have actually generated more prosperity and more inequality at the same time. And until 2010, and that's what this talk is in some ways about, until 2010, you very much got the sense that a majority of people actually supported the president, that in fact the first sorts of claims that were made after the Egyptian uprising got underway were not for toppling the regime. They were for instituting reforms. It took a long time for that kind of demand to topple the regime to get underway, and it was very much in response to a kind of excess of reaction on the part of the regime. Lais Hedju and I were talking yesterday, though, even today, it could be argued that if there were elections, presidential elections held today, that the president would win, not by 99.2% of the vote, maybe by a slim margin, but there is certainly a great deal of popularity, some of what is called in newspaper reports that silent majority, are people who are very much still in support of him. And there are many more who are ambivalent. And I'm interested in that ambivalence. By ambivalence, I don't mean ambiguity. I don't mean what I was talking about in the first book. I mean a kind of uncertainty that has arisen as their investment in the good life is no longer as plausible as it was before. So I think that one of the regime's very powerful ideological effects until quite recently was its ability to outsource
its ideological instruments to people who were much more sophisticated in relationship to producing not necessarily the kind of old, tried and true maxims of the Ba'ath Party, but a sense of the good life that made sense and that tethered that sense of economic well-being to a certain sense of state and existential security. And I think the regime was extraordinarily good at doing that until quite recently. So I don't think that there's anything that I'm saying today that would contradict your story. I do think that what you're pointing to is a limitation in the first book, both a limitation of time and a limitation of the question, which was very narrow. Thank you.
I just want to apply my comment to the origins of contention. Whether this increasing opposition and challenges towards the status quo actually fostered through the increasing liberalization and the openness of the regime via social mobility or the decreasing trade, intrusive politics, the spread of market culture, what you call cafe culture, or these episodes of contention are better explained as a consequence of, as an outcome of booming inequality, or are better explained in terms of case-specific aspects and idiosyncratic histories? Or should we start from micro-foundations and the individual strategic and highly contingent choices in very specific moments? Because it's a problem, I work in contingent politics and episodes of contingency, but apply to Western cases. And I don't know where to start to explain this.
So I'm going to answer you, and then I'm going to translate your question to Mr. Hadju, because he may have another answer that would, in some ways, be more interesting for me.
Okay.
So I think it's all of what you say. I think it is about a combinatorial power, if you will, of having a kind of economic inequality, which has gone on for the last 10 years and has become, has a specific geography to it. The 5 years of drought, for example, in the countryside, the movement thereby of people from the countryside into shanty towns around the cities, very important to an understanding of people's disaffection and a sense of limited possibilities or foreclosed possibilities. Now, had nothing happened in Tunisia or Egypt, I don't think anything would have happened in Syria either. So there is a contingency that has to do with a certain kind of diffusion effect, if you will. But there are also contingencies that have to do with specific decisions that the regime made at times that turned a movement that was extraordinarily small into a movement that's much bigger. Still not as big as, say, Yemen, where 25% of the people went into the streets, or Egypt, for example, where you have 1 million people in Tahrir, which proportionally isn't that many, in fact, but nonetheless, Cairo is a major city there. But so I think it is a combination of having these sort of economic conditions and also an ideal that thinking about this in terms of ideology is thinking about it in terms of an uneven, not simply economic distribution, but also an uneven suffusion of ideological uptake, if you will, where some people could imagine or aspire to the good life and other people couldn't. That's mapped on to some extent to economics, but that cannot be reduced to it. And I think it is also about contingent circumstances. And I think one of the problems in social science is that one has to choose one or the other, when in fact, in reality, it's almost always both, right? And if one has to think about, say, the relationship between structure and agency, mm-hmm. one needs to think, I think, in dialectical terms. Otherwise, it just doesn't make sense that they co-implicate each other. Now, in certain circumstances, one may be more determinative than the other. But to sign up for one at the expense of the other just seems like, I don't know, it seems kooky and old-fashioned and actually does a disservice to our desire to theorize about the real world. Now I'm going to ask him the question in somewhat different form, if you don't mind, so that we can get an answer that would probably make a certain amount of sense. هو بده يعرف انه انا المعارضه وانا الناس اللي عم بيظاهروا هلا مو بس المعارضه المنظمه بس كمان الناس اللي عم بيظاهروا ليش هن عم بيظاهروا هلا برايك اوكي I'll translate as he
ما في في حاله فوضى في اكثر من اسباب للتظاهر كانت اسباب اداريه العلاقه بالحياه العامه اليوم تحولت لاسباب العلاقه بالانتقام وبدوافع
Oh, he says that there are many reasons. It can't be reduced to one reason, and that there are issues around public life and issues around the sort of political organization. But there are also, you know, certain aspects of this are about a certain kind of chaos or something that has come into being that has also enabled. People to rebel in a way that they couldn't before, that the sorts of obstacles to rebellion have also gone away as that politics of obedience that I was talking about before has also slipped. And I would add to that, it's a very important point, I would add to that that some of the resistance has come up because of the regime's excessive use of coercive force, maybe a contingent thing, maybe also structural in the sense that they don't know how to do otherwise, right? I mean, that's the structure of autocracy in a way, is to quash rebellion. But because of that, people are killing each other out of revenge. So some of this is not necessarily as politically motivated as it's, or politically in a more sort of master narrative sense, but is also about people, and this is the chaos, the folder situation. It has to do in part with people actually taking revenge on one another as a result of these conditions of turmoil that are existing.
صار في حالة انقسام بالرأي عم بيعبروا عنا بحالة اليوم ابتداء من التظاهر إلى القتل.
That there's a kind of split now, that and there's also been a transformation of these demonstrations into killings that look much more like, he didn't say civil war, but something like a civil war.
يعني حتى لو تحققت كل المطالب اللي طالبت فيها بداية التظاهرات اليوم هذا ما راح يوقف الشارع.
He said, so for example, all of the kinds of demands that were made initially, the kinds of things like freedom, dignity, those you don't hear very much in the streets anymore.
First of all, I would like to thank for the opportunity of having this conversation, this talk. First of all, I would like to congratulate. It's from my point of view, it's a very honest work. You know, a very honest research. Also for Mr. Hayu, I think it's something loyal and admirable, and it's a pretty nice work. You know, yeah. So, second one, I would like to comment something that we were talking in the hall. That's you know, the meaning of the words, the meaning of some concepts that are being there. You know, in this liberal democracies or the one that pretends to be liberal democracy. But there are some words that all the time you are listening, like ideologies, like rights, like democracy. But sometimes in some societies we don't have the entire or the whole of the whole meaning of what it means. You know what I mean? So it's like ideology. There are some places that okay, you can be just saying that you have an ideology, but you really don't know what you're thinking about an issue or a position of something. Right? Okay. But why are you right? As the film was like that, you know, like you really don't know why are you right. So what could you be demanding? So another one is democracy. As we were talking about this, Mexico happened something like that. We have this set of words in our common life, but we didn't know what it means. So this is something that happened 20 years ago, more or less, and we were talking about this kind of thing. So what happened? What's the matter with this? We have it in a regime of a one-party system, so it's not real democracy, you know. It's not a real democracy. I think that this kind of turmoils begins with the necessity of knowing, of know what these words mean, right? So I mean, in Mexico, we were demanding some rights when suddenly we see that we had material goods, you know, and we say, okay, but what else? I mean, economically, is more or less okay, but something is missing, yeah. Right? So that's why I think this is a very interesting work. The third point is a question indeed, and it's a question for Mr. Hayu. How is it possible to hide this serious or strong message in a humor sense? How is it possible? And I really don't know, because how could you still be? I don't want to sound a little bit bad about this, but how can you still be alive? I mean, how can you avoid this persecution of the regime? For me, it's something that's admirable.
هو عم بيسألك كيف أنت فهمت؟ أوكي.
لازم نعترف بالزمن بحكم بشار الأسد صار في كتير انفتاح واضح على مستوى الإعلام وعلى مستوى الحريات بشكل عام لما ما كانت هدد بخطر.
He said that one does have to appreciate the time period that he was working in under Bashar al-Assad. This last decade, there was more freedom than there had been before and a great deal more possibilities for expressing oneself. So he wasn't doing something that made him afraid. He said maybe also there was the belief among regime members that this wouldn't really have all that much influence on the streets. And that he also wanted there, he believed in there being a kind of civil movement that was not as extreme as the kind of Islamic alternatives that were operative. And so that this in some ways is a pedagogical project, but one where he was hoping that he would be able to connect with people on the street, but in a way, again, that did not have the kind of excessiveness or extremism of the Islamic sort of opposition, which was a different kind of alternative.
وهذا أعتقد أنه شيء فعلاً يسجل النظام ولازم نعترف فيه بهذا الانفتاح اللي ما بيشبه كل المنطقة العربية اليوم اللي عم بيطالبوا بهي الحريات دول الخليج عم بيحاولوا يعلموا سوريا الديمقراطية والإنين ما حصلوا على جزء بنسبة بسيطة من اللي قدموا لسوريا وهذا لازم نعترف فيه.
And that also one does have to appreciate, in spite of whatever one else wants to say about the Syrian regime, that in fact, in this way, it was not nearly as repressive as the regimes in the Gulf, who are these days, basically attempting to overthrow the regime of Bashar al-Assad. So that there's a kind of, he didn't use this word, now I'm saying myself, a kind of hypocrisy involved in the Gulf countries being so up in arms about this, that there was a kind of freedom of expression in Syria under Bashar, not so much under the father, although ambiguity shows that even under the father there was some, that of course at this point has been complicated by the uprising, to say the least, but that kind of freedom of expression is not present in many other of the Gulf monarchies who are calling for the demise of the unfree Syrian regime, so that there's a level of hypocrisy here that he wanted to draw our attention to. I'll also answer just one your other question about, I think there's an issue about terms here, social science terms. So one of the things that my previous work in Yemen tried to do was to also enrich our understanding of democracy, not by going and making definitions that aren't out there, that aren't recognizable to us, but by actually bringing back into the term some of the components of it, some of the elements of what we mean when we talk about democracy, that have in fact been lost by signing up for a certain kind of social science. The social science of people like Jaworski et al., or the kind of large and quantitative work that folks tend to do, actually has consequences for our social science definitions, and there are political stakes in choosing those definitions. So if one's thinking about democracy as contested elections, for example, and one's studying the world in terms of that being the priority, then a lot of the other aspects of democracy get evacuated from the term. And I think this is deeply disturbing, and one that has not had enough scrutiny in the context of our social science work. That was one aspect of your question. The other aspect of the question is one, well, if people on the street don't understand what they're making claims about, isn't that a problem? And that I actually would like to turn and ask Mr. Hedjou about in the context of Syria, because I think it's of a more interesting issue for him to respond to. هو كان بيسأل كمان سؤال ثاني إنه أحيانا وهو بيشوف من وجهة نظره ومن تجربته بمكسيكا إن مكسيكو؟ مكسيك إنه شكرا إنه أحيانا الناس مطالبات هني عم بيقولوا هورية أو الانتخابات أو الديمقراطية وما بيفهموا شو معناتها بس عم بيقولوا
That's right. وإحنا حصلت معنا التجربة فتنا بمظاهرة أنا ونضال سجري الممثل هون وفعلا طلبونا إنه نقول حرية فسألوا نضال الأشخاص إنه شو الحرية قال له ما بعرف بس قول حرية وخلاص.
So he completely agrees with you, and he has his own personal experience to relate to you in this way, which is that he and one of the actors from the film, the guy who looks like Larry or Curly or, you know, so they went into the streets initially when people were protesting in Ladiya in the end of March, around March 26, 27, 28. Those are my dates, not his, but I do remember. Because he stood me up for dinner, that's why I remember. So, and he went into the streets with the Nidal Sejri in Ladiya and was talking to people about the meaning of the word freedom. And among demonstrators, and there were some people who were being encouraged to demonstrate, and they're like, "Well, we don't know what freedom is." They said, "Don't worry, just say it and demonstrate." There was that kind of almost sense of being part of something pleasurable. This is me now again, being part of something pleasurable and about a certain kind of group solidarity, independent of demands that people didn't fully understand. I should say, though, that lest we think that these concepts are particularly problematic for Mexico or Syria, you go onto the streets in Chicago and you ask somebody what democracy means. Mm-hmm. NPR did this recently, and it's hilarious. I mean, you have so many different... So one person said, anti-communism. And the next person said, redistribution of income, you know, communism. Another person said, contestable. I mean, no one had the same meaning of the term, and that's the richness of the term, but also perhaps one of its dangers. But this is not specific to Mexico or Syria. We would find this kind of polyvalence, I think, in fact, in the streets of Chicago.
One question for both of you. If I can remember a title of one of the chapters of your book, it was something like Killing Politics.
Yeah, chapter two.
Then this is a very important question, because this regime is a politics of killing politics. And after so many years of killing politics, and provided that the first object of mobilization, political mobilization, is to build something like an us, people, this, consulting in some kind of unity. This is a difficult task, provided yes. these devices, symbolic and otherwise, to a fragmentation of the population. And I, in this field of how to build some collective identity, new political identity, appear some very important problems, for example, from the point of view of the discourse. The question is there some particular frame that, say, dignity or liberty, freedom, or I don't know, because this is a very competitive issue with Allah Akbar, with other interpellations
yeah.
in the Althusserian sense of in a new identity. That is there emerging some clearly or not main frame of interpretation for this us as people or nation or Syrian people fighting for our freedom? Second question, trust. Killing politics is generate distrust or even focalized trust,
mm-hmm.
Specific yes, to yes, one person, absolutely. To a party, to a religion, the leaders of this religion, which is the mobilization, the organization basis to construct this general trust of this the main characteristic of the citizenship, no? This general trust, because focal trust is just mistrust of others, mm-hmm. citizens. In democracy, we need mistrust of the politicians, mistrust of distrust even the institutions, but this confidence, this trust in the other citizens, because we can mobilize horizontally, and which is your opinion about this new? Is emerging some possibilities for emerging this generalized universal trust of citizens, of us fighting, and not focalized through a leader, through a party, a religion?
Mm-hmm.
And third question, the religious divide in this constructing of people as in collective identity. This divide between Shi'i and Salafism is operating, is difficult to generalize critically, for example, the sense of humor, mm-hmm. because this religious perspective is different from to capture this sense of humor, political sense of humor, not just it's a very important divide, because, for example, the precedence of the leader or the leader of the opposition, from which religious tendency, no? Mm-hmm. The Assad mm-hmm. one, the opposition the other one. This how is what is at stake in this specific issue?
So I'm going to translate the second two questions uh-huh. to Laith now, okay. and he'll answer first, and then okay. So هو عنده سؤالين لك. أول سؤال عن الثقة وشو طبعا تحت سيطرة نظام ديكتاتوري أحيانا الناس ما يقدروا يثقوا من بعض, بس في نفس الوقت في ثقة مثلا بين الناس بنفس الشلة أو شيء. هو بده يعرف لو هل في تطورات أو تغيرات بالنسبة للثقة خلال فترة ال الانتفاضة فينا نقول أو الثورة. هي السؤال الأول عفوا. والسؤال سؤال الثاني شكرا, إنه
بالنسبة للكوميديا تبعتك، هل السلفيين والإخوان والناس اللي متدينين أو متطرفين حتى فينا نقول، هل هن يقدروا يضحكوا على نفس الأشياء اللي أنت عم تضحك عليه؟ وشو المجموعات اللي تضحك أكثر عن الكوميديا اللي أنت بتسويها؟
بالنسبة للسؤال الأول، الثقة انعدمت أكثر من قبل. أثبت الشعب السوري تراجعت
أيوة،
وأثبتت حالة الحلقة الأولى فعلا أنه هو شعب يبدو متعود على أنه دائما يكون في حدا فساد. على اليوم اللي عم بيصير هو في أكثر انتشار لهذه الحالة، انعدام للثقة بشكل أكبر بالشارع. هذا بالنسبة للسؤال الأول.
أوكي.
يبدو شيء متأصل من زمان بآلية وعي هذا الشعب.
He thinks that there has been a significant kind of regression, return, a backward movement of confidence or trust in the context of the uprising, because there are many people outside of their particular groups who cannot trust one another now, and the stakes of, you know, saying something now are very different than they were before. So that's an issue, and that means also that the episodes like the one about the snitch become particularly important, because they register a feeling of anxiety that is in perhaps in many ways more prevalent now than it was when he was filming.
بالنسبة للسلفيين، ما في هذا الفوارق الكبيرة بسوريا بين الشعب، بين السلفيين وبين الليبراليين، والكل بيتعامل على الأقل مع المواد اللي تقدمت بشكل متساوي.
بمعنى أنه هن يقدروا يتفرجوا عليه بدون ما يكون في أي مشكلة.
بدون أي مشكلة، بس بتجارب كانت المشكلة بالاقتراب منهم كان خط أحمر أكثر بكثير من النظام نفسه. يعني نحن بسوريا فينا نحكي عن النظام بأكثر حرية ما نحكي عن السلفيين.
So the Salafis, for example, and people who are more identified with a kind of Islamic activism can enjoy these comedy skits as well. But he thought that in some ways the censorship, for his mind, it was harder to deal with them in a way than it was to deal with the regime, that there were certain kinds of constraints that he had even in his head as he was producing. And this is even, I think, more true for folks who are tackling religious issues in particular in their not necessarily comedies, but in their television serials, that they're more worried about a reaction from Salafis or from people who are so-called Islamic fundamentalists than they were from the regime. And to some extent, the regime's modernizing, secularizing impulses are at one with some of the television folks' episodes, but with regard to his comedies, this was not particularly a problem because it wasn't raising religious issues per se. Yeah. Oh, and so about killing politics and politics is never killed off completely. I mean, let's face it, it just never is. It's one of the greatest things about politics. There are always people willing to die for causes or express themselves politically and understand that there is something to be had in thinking through problems in concert with others, and that to some extent one learns freedom by enacting it with others. And so I think that's important, and that was not exhausted even under the rule of Hafez al-Assad. And there were a lot of people that were put in prison, and there was a lot of repression, but there were also ways in which people worked the weaknesses of the system and got things done. Organized politics was much harder, and one of the reasons I moved to Yemen after being in Syria for so long is I really needed to breathe what I felt was kind of stolen oxygen, because in Yemen, I mean, what you got was a lot more chaos or a lot more disorder, but also a lot more freedom to express oneself in public, and it was pretty extraordinary how much vivacious, vibrant political activity was happening in Yemen. Going back to Syria, though, I have to say, under the years of Bashar al-Assad, I was quite surprised by a certain kind of transformation in the discursive sociabilities that were enabled by that world. Now, you know, organizing into a political party was a different story, but being able to talk about politics, even being able to say his name in public, these kinds of things were relatively new, and they were being taken up by people, and they were also generating their own sense of humor, including the kinds of comedies we saw here. I do think, though, that the fact is that the opposition has remained fragmented to the extent that it has is in part a success of 40 years of autocracy. It's also, though, and this is what I'm also trying to suggest here, it may be also the combination of that coercive capacity of the state in its disciplinary and more overtly coercive aspects, but also perhaps a certain registration of our times more generally, a global phenomenon in which our ability to come up with political programs that are meaningful and shared, that really actually do more than simply offer up a mild critique of neoliberalism, are very, very hard to find anywhere in the world. So I think that there's a combination of the kind of 40 years of autocracy with a kind of success of, for lack of a better term, neoliberal ideological mechanisms of social control that make the possibility of a unified opposition with a political program that does more than say, make them go away, difficult to achieve. He wants to say one more thing about the question previously.
Mm-hmm.
The Salafis are part of the opposition today, that's for sure.
هو اللي رح يأكل فلقة وهذا بيمثل تماماً حالة معارضة اللي هي تشبه ديكتاتورية النظام نفسه.
That there is a way in which, and this is an anxiety that Mr. Hajju has, that the opposition today, to some extent, uses the very practices of the regime itself, and that there are lines in both Dea Dea, well, especially in Dea Dea, particularly one line that. Underscores this, that there is a way in which the kind of repressive capacities that the regime had and continues to have are being picked up by the opposition and used in different ways, but also suggest a kind of potentially lamentable situation in which there would be an absence of free speech, for example, and also possibilities of social control that would be in no way what, say, organizers or certainly certain people from the West imagined this opposition to be like, so that the opposition is not necessarily as democratic as people want to believe, and the Salafi contingent of it would be an aspect of that lack of democracy. And there is a line from Dea Dea that actually suggests that when they talk about the use of a fala, it was a kind of torture where you hit the bottom of your feet. And that can be used by anybody. And of course, the Human Rights Watch recently did a report on the Free Syrian Army, which has a very sectarian orientation to it, and which suggested that they were also committing serious human rights abuses. And as you know probably better than most, having maybe not yourselves lived through a civil war, but your parents and grandparents having lived through the civil war, that the civil war produces atrocities on all sides.
First, I think the second point that Professor Might brought up to the table is crucial. I think it's the basics of democracy, as Ricard puts it, like 40 years ago or so. The secret of democracy is about finding this eclectic, messy balance between consensus and dissension. And so that's the challenge, and that's as easy like that and as hard as that. So, but moving on to the overall puzzle of the Syrian situation, some authors or some scholars have argued that the episodes of contention are explained by the emergence of a new social cleavage. By new, I mean anything as opposed to the traditional ones, which is what Lipset and Rock and developed. So in this case, could be explained in terms of, let's say, Syrians, or like 10 years ago, every Syrian opposed to Al-Assad, or which criticized openly Al-Assad regime, was an anti-Syrian person, and among some sort of social fabric, the situation is changing, or this association does not hold anymore. Some of us can be against Al-Assad or against this particular status quo, but we are still Syrians. Could that explain this sort of?
I'm going to ask Mr. Hudger the same question, but let me just respond first a little bit. If I understand your question correctly, because I'm not sure I do, but if I do, then I would say it's not true that, I mean, it depends who you were talking to. If people were actually anti-Assad, you could end up being more Syrian, because there's no necessary connection between signing up for the leader and being Syrian. It depends who your addressees are, right? So if you're spending 30 years in prison, there are plenty of people who think you're doing that because you care so much about Syria. And that was true before, and that continues to be true. In the same way that, you know, in the United States, if you go out and protest, there are people who are going to say you're anti-American, and there are other people who are going to say, no, that's the basis of America. The same thing, I think, is true in Syria. Whether there are new social cleavages developing at the moment that are helping to produce this contention, I think, is a separate question. And let me ask Mr. Hudju that first, and then I'll come in if I need to. هو بده يعرف إذا مثلا كان في بعض المجموعات المختلفة فينا نقول اللي كان بسوريا من قبل الانتفاضة وهل هل نحن عم بنشوف مجموعات الجديدة أو الانقسامات الجديدة مثل الأشياء الطائفية والأشياء الدينية أو الأشياء الطبقية شو العلاقة بين المجموعات الجديدة اللي نحن بنشوفها والمظاهرات والمعارضة اللي نحن عم نشوفها خلال فترة الانتفاضة
هي المظاهرات انتهت بانتشار حالة الانقسامات الجديدة اليوم ما عاد في مظاهرات اليوم صار في انقسامات يعني بانتشار الحالة الطائفية والانقسامات
He says that really today you can't talk about demonstrations in the same way that you could in the past. They've really ended, and what you're seeing now is the kind of solidification of these cleavages.
صار الخوف من شيء أكبر له علاقة ب ب بانقسام طائفي غطت كل المطالب الحياتية والمعيشية اللي كان عم يطالب فيها طالب فيها بالمظاهرات وهذا أدى لأكثر تمرد أو أكثر
فهمت عليك
تشدد من كل الأطراف
He said that the emergence of particularly sectarian affiliations as being especially salient in this new phase of violence has meant that some of the claims for dignity or for material gains that were prevalent in the demonstration phase have gone away as the situation has become more extreme. I would say that as well. I would argue, though, that the sectarianism is you're watching to some extent. This is not true everywhere, but the regime has also produced the problem that then requires the state solution. That is to say, they have helped to cultivate, to some extent, these sectarian schisms, and in doing so, have then produced more violence in its wake. But with the idea, I think in principle, it hasn't worked out this way, that the state would then protect people from themselves. That hasn't worked in large part because they can't protect their own militias at this point, or they can't control their own militias. So you see a real fragmentation happening. At the same time that you see more extremism, you see more fragmentation happening. And that's happening at the level of both
the opposition and at the level of the regime itself. It's not clear to me, for example, that the massacre at Al-Hula, which is very, first of all, it's not clear to me who did it, but you know, if we acknowledge or we think that the regime did it, what the regime is in this context actually is not clear as well. And that has something to do with this new phase of violence. He said one of the problems in relationship to this uprising is that there you really have not had a contribution of new ideas from intellectuals. And if you don't have those kinds of ideas coming out from what he didn't say secular elite, but that's what he means, then what you'll end up with is the pulpit of the mosque having much more power. And then you have Christians and other minorities fleeing to the regime as a way of protecting themselves both existentially and materially from what they fear would be a much more extreme Islamic theological state.
Thank you
very much for your time. I really appreciate it. And they're great questions. Sorry, the language barriers are such.
Thank you.